The U.S. Navy is sending warships to the Caribbean. Not everyone is convinced they're doing it to stop drug smugglers.
It's a massive buildup, many, many times more extravagant than we would ever need for a counter-narcotics operation.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, what's going on between the U.S. and Venezuela. Also, the U.N. climate summit underway in Brazil builds on a 10-year-old agreement. The motivation for it was clear.
Working on climate means improving the quality of life of all of us.
We'll get a status update.
And hear about a disturbing trend in Sweden.
When it comes to gang-related violence crimes, it's almost always kids.
Plus, dancing nonstop for 6 days for global glory.
All that and more today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Glad you could make it today. Venezuela says it's moving quickly to mobilize its military, calling up land, air, naval, and reserve forces. That's in response to the Pentagon's biggest naval buildup in the Caribbean since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. Washington says it's bolstering forces in the region to combat drug trafficking.
But there is growing concern that the real goal is to topple the government of Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. It's not just the Venezuelan government and its allies that are concerned. So are critics of the U.S. policy. We turned to former CIA analyst Fulton Armstrong for insight. He's at American University's Center for Latin American and Latino Studies in Washington, D.C.
It's a massive buildup. Many, many times more extravagant than we would ever need for a counter-narcotics operation, clearly directed at putting pressure on Venezuela. And they believe, this is the administration, believes that by taking Venezuela down, they'll also be taking down Cuba in the same process. And these are scare tactics that they're doing to trigger. I think they have a range of desired options to trigger, first and foremost, an internal coup. They seem to have intelligence that the military could rise up and overthrow Maduro. The second one would be maybe attack something on an island, an offshore island, or something symbolic of the Venezuelan government and Maduro's government. Or if they have to, just strike something that they could claim that they have intelligence on is directing either the flow of the drugs or some other nefarious activities out of Caracas itself.
Do you believe that this massing of forces off the coast of Venezuela is meant as a scare tactic to force some internal change, or do you think they actually would be prepared to launch some sort of surgical strikes?
I think it's mostly a scare tactic, but it's also one thing that's quite important in this whole story. Whether you look at it as a counter-narcotics thing or a counter-Venezuela thing, counter-Cuba thing, this is ultimately primarily a U.S. domestic political enterprise that they've launched here. They want to look tough. They want to look like they're going to crush the drug trade, which it's completely impossible by doing it this way, especially because fentanyl, which is the major threat drug, doesn't come even remotely near the Caribbean. But the idea would be to look tough on drugs, but also look tough on these two or three governments in Latin America that have thumbed their noses at us for many years, defied us, and not yielded to our will. At some point, though, when you huff and puff and try to blow down somebody's house and it doesn't fall, you're going to have to do something. And that's why I think it makes sense to look at scenarios that go far short of boots on the ground, because we would not do well on the ground. We would do shock and awe in the early phases of an invasion or an attack on Caracas, for example. But this is a complicated country. Probably now the population is about 30 million people. And while even those that have doubts about Maduro as their president, watch out, don't go after my president of any stripe, because I'm gonna then trip you up. And
right.
I think the U.S. has shown in Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq that political resistance is something that we do not do well. And it could be a little bit in that way a quagmire for the United States.
You have said before that Venezuela will likely respond asymmetrically to a U.S. invasion. Can you explain what that would look like?
I think the armed forces itself would melt away quite quickly if there were some boots on the ground sort of action. If there were some flash bang sorts of attacks on a couple of government ministries, maybe even a limousine or two, they would probably watch first which way the winds are going and whether boots were coming soon behind. But they will shoot at a foreigner that comes in and threatens them. They have the spirit of Bolivar, the history of the great liberator of South America, and they will unify, even if they don't really like the way the government has been running the situation for so many years. They will come and defend their national honor and their families. One of the mistakes that our policy has made is that we've also drawn a line and said we'll seek retribution or justice, we call it justice, against most of the senior military officers. Where are they going to go? They're not going to go surrender, so they're going to go and try to help people do these asymmetrical sorts of counterattacks against us.
We learned today that the country of Colombia will stop sharing intelligence with Washington. The UK is also pausing some intelligence sharing with Washington, arguably, you know, the U.S.'s closest ally, because of the U.S. military strikes in the Caribbean. How significant are those two pieces of news?
I think that they're significant to us politically, diplomatically, maybe even morally, but operationally, we would not be overly dependent at this phase when we've got aircraft carriers, we've got signals intelligence aircraft and boats, and we've got all this incredible technology arrayed there. Our information for operational purposes, for military operation purposes, is going to be superior to anything that anybody else could be giving us. But it is still a significant slap in the face of the United States because they don't want to be partners. They don't want to be accomplices in the attacks against vessels that are not even identified. And so if you were Colombia, that's part of the neighborhood that lives next door, or you're the UK, and you're providing intelligence to the United States to go out and have our guys in uniform be the investigator, the cop, the prosecutor, the judge, the jury, and the executioner, all within a matter of minutes or hours. That's just not something that they want to be part of.
Fulton Armstrong was a CIA analyst in Latin America. He's now a senior fellow at American University's Center for Latin American and Latino Studies in Washington, D.C.
Two Swedish teenagers charged with terrorism went on trial today in Denmark. They were arrested last year after throwing hand grenades at the Israeli embassy in Copenhagen. Swedish authorities say the case represents a growing problem, children and teenagers being recruited by criminal gangs. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports on a radical measure the Swedish government is proposing to address that.
The two Swedish teenagers were 16 and 19 when they were arrested in Copenhagen last October. Under police interrogation, the younger of the two said he had started working for a criminal gang in Stockholm when he was just 11 years old. At first, it was small jobs, he said, transporting drugs for cash. But by the age of 14, he told police, he was being asked to do things he didn't want to do. He was told he had no other choice, he said. Swedish prosecutor Lisa Dos Santos says she's heard stories like this one countless times before.
I work in the biggest prosecution office in Sweden, and when it comes to the gang-related violence crimes, it's almost always kids. There are a lot of older people taking part in the planning, organizing, but a kid is the one who shoots and puts the house on fire or doing the bombing.
A big reason for that, Dos Santos says, is because gang leaders know the younger the child, the less likely it is that they'll do time. So the Swedish government has a new idea, lowering the age of criminal responsibility to just 13. That means children as young as 13 could end up in prison. Prosecutor Dos Santos doesn't think that's a great solution, but she says the authorities are running out of options.
We're not talking about kids in general. We're talking about kids that commit murders and bombings. I mean, of course, we have to look at the child, but these kids are also dangerous.
Social workers, legal experts and children's rights organisations are fiercely opposed to the government's plan. The prison service is already under immense pressure, says Anna Dorian with Bris, a children's rights charity in Stockholm.
They're not able to even make sure that grown-ups in prisons today are given their basic human rights, such as not being isolated for too long, making sure that they have their education and so on and so forth. And we're really worried what will happen when you place children into these locations.
Right now, teens who commit serious crimes in Sweden get sent to youth care homes. Dorian says those homes often struggle to cope with the number of youngsters in their care. A report out today found that dozens of children have continued to commit serious crimes while living in these institutions. Still, Dorian says, the government should be talking about investing in or reforming these homes, not jailing children.
If we imprison even younger children, we are very certain that these networks will only recruit even younger children.
Most young people targeted come from very vulnerable backgrounds, she says. In the last few years, gang leaders have turned increasingly to social media to recruit new members. Prosecutor Lisa Dos Santos says that's how kids from across Sweden end up committing violent crimes, even in Denmark.
They put out assignment in social media and then they create group chats in applications like Signal and Wire and Wicker. And we see that kids come from different cities to commit crimes for gangs that they haven't met and they don't have a motive to kill or bomb the target, except for getting money or status or thrills.
Criminologists say kids often commit these crimes out of fear or to earn respect from gang leaders. Poverty, lack of resources for youth services and segregated neighbourhoods, these are all factors that exacerbate the problem, says Emily Wulfstrand. She's with Verdandi, a social justice organisation in Stockholm. But the Swedish government, she says, is only interested in talking about punishment.
I think we have a government who just want to punish and to show that they are hard on crimes. So they've been talking about this ever since they won the election.
And that was 3 years ago. Now, with another election looming next year, hardcore measures like lowering the age of criminal responsibility are back on the table, Wulfstrand says. But implementing the proposal might not be all that easy. Last night, the Swedish Prison and Probation Service said in a statement it was not prepared or equipped to take care of children as young as 14, let alone 13. Children as young as 13 years old should be cared for in other ways, the prison service said. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
It is a sad day for the record books of Sofia, Bulgaria. The city used to hold the world record for most bagpipers piping together in one place at one time, but no more.
Today, Melbourne, Australia claimed that distinction when 374 pipers proudly reached for the repertoire of national rock heroes AC/DC and their anthem, It's a Long Way to the Top If You Want to Rock and Roll. The event was dubbed the Great Melbourne Bagpipe Bash. Gavin Davey was one of the musicians.
Well, I've been playing bagpipes since I was 9, and I'm just sort of thinking this would be a bit of fun towards the end of my career. Go out with a bang.
The record-breaking performance took place in Melbourne's Federation Square. That is also where AC/DC shot the 1976 music video for the song. In that video, the band rocks out on a flatbed truck that's driving through the city's streets. And you may remember that the original song actually has a bagpipe solo.
Federation Square is also just a short distance from the Melbourne Cricket Ground, and that's where AC/DC is getting ready to perform tonight in its first Australian gig in a decade.
I wonder if the real AC/DC was watching this bagpipe AC/DC.
Yeah, cameo appearance tonight, perhaps? That would be something.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The COP30 climate summit in Belém, Brazil, right now, marks 10 years since the landmark Paris Agreement. That legally binding treaty set the expectations for reducing emissions and moving countries off of fossil fuels. Cristiana Figueres was at the center of pushing that agreement through. We reached her in Belém this week to reflect on what's changed over the past decade.
Before the adoption of the Paris Agreement, the world was actually heading for a warming of anywhere between 4 to 6 degrees by the end of the century. And with the adoption of the Paris Agreement, the projection for temperature increase came down to 2.6.
And what did we have access to 10 years ago when it comes to renewable technologies and electrification?
Every single one of the renewable technologies were still in their infancy stage. Solar was in its infancy. It has been deployed 15 times faster than predicted. The electric vehicle industry has just gone exponential. 10 years ago, we had 1 in every 100 vehicles sold into the market being electric, and today we have 1 in 5. So all of these technologies have gone through exponential S-curves of improvement, and they have all bottomed out with respect to their cost.
So take us back to the moment the agreement was actually reached in Paris. How did that happen? Because I remember covering it from Boston. It came down to a very close deadline, right? Lots of walking back and forth in the hallways of the Paris Convention Center.
Well, it always is like that, having been to many, many COPs, more than 20 COPs. But I think what is really important is that Paris 10 years ago was the moment in which countries realized that addressing climate change is in their enlightened self-interest. To become more and more energy independent, to always have better health conditions, better transport, agriculture, and better food production. The fact is that working on climate means improving the quality of life of all of us today and giving a better chance of well-being for future generations.
Well, indeed. I mean, representatives at the Paris COP knew ultimately the agreement was about saving people. How did it feel in that moment once you crossed the finish line?
I remember first being completely glued to my seat for what seemed like 10 years, but apparently was only a few seconds, until I jumped out of my seat and 5,000 people in the hall jumped out of their seats and they were clapping and crying and everyone was so elated that so much work had gone into this. It was a very moving moment.
It was just a start, though, in Paris. What were the hopes at the time of what this agreement would achieve?
The hopes were that it would achieve what it is achieving now. Of course, we knew even then that it is definitely a multi-decadal process, but that it would give the political signal for every other stakeholder, be it the private sector, investors, technology providers, science, for everyone to then double down and go, okay, now that we have agreement about the what, that is a net zero economy by 2050, now it's about how do we do that in every single sector.
So looking back with 10 years of hindsight, what have been the primary mechanisms to really bring the impacts of human-made climate change under control?
Well, you could say that to a certain extent, it's the political signal, and that is definitely true, and that is known as the Paris effect. But what is really exciting is the fact that 10 years hence, the center of gravity, of action, of opportunity, of progress has actually migrated away from the international or the multilateral level of governments to what we used to call, when I was in the United Nations Secretariat, the real world. So now the opportunity, the progress, the imperatives are actually coming from the market, from what I call climate economics. We're shifting from climate politics and diplomacy to climate economics. And that is irreversible. It is gaining momentum every single day. Speed and scale remain the challenge.
I'm speaking with Cristiana Figueres. She helped negotiate the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. We should also say that the Paris Agreement has fallen short. It established 1.5 degrees Celsius as the threshold we needed to keep warming temperatures below in order to avoid the worst consequences of climate change. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has said that we've blown past that limit. Why have we failed on this target?
So I wouldn't say we have failed. I would say, actually, we're not there yet.
This is a new economy that is being built, that is being reconfigured from the ground up. And no overarching economic structure can be changed from Sunday to Monday. 10 years have shown that it is entirely possible, but they have not guaranteed yet that we have been able to take in all the sectors, because this still is a new experience, a new challenge that we have. I think we have to recognize that the outcome that we have for ourselves has become more difficult to achieve, and hence, we have to redouble our efforts.
And why have they become more difficult to achieve?
Because we underestimated the effects of uncontrolled and catastrophic natural events. We could not have predicted the types of hurricanes, the types of typhoons that we're seeing, for example, in the Philippines or Melissa in the Caribbean. We could not have foreseen that they would be as devastating as they are.
Another point of criticism has been that the nationally determined contributions, which are in effect national plans to reduce carbon emissions, are not nearly ambitious enough to meet the realities of climate change. What is your assessment of that?
The GAP report, which brings together the NDCs, is incomplete. But I think we also have to remember that these national plans reflect much more what is politically expedient rather than a reflection of what is actually going on in the ground. I would say that China has once again underpromised and will once again overdeliver. But that attitude of underpromising and overdelivering, I think, has now been practiced by several other countries because of the threats of international trade.
So COP30 in Belém just getting underway. There's been a lot of criticism of these negotiations over the past decade that they're not effective. In your view, Christiana, what is the larger value or benefit to these meetings? How do you respond to that criticism?
We now have substantially the rule book, the critical route toward decarbonizing the economy. It is critical for national governments to reflect to each other what they're doing and, in fact, witness what the private sector is doing so that next time they can be a little bit more ambitious about what political promises they put on the table.
What do you see as the legacy of the Paris Agreement? And I feel remiss if I didn't ask you, with the U.S. in, then in, and now out again, how much of that is part of the legacy?
The legacy of the Paris Agreement is precisely to have served as the guardrails of decarbonization and of modernization. We don't want a carbon-intensive economy. What do we want is an economy that is effective, that is efficient. We also want a planet that is more just. We still have 600 million people who don't even have access to electricity. That is not a problem that can be solved by the fossil fuels, but rather by renewables.
That's Christiana Figueres. She led the Paris Agreement climate negotiations in 2015, the cornerstone of global efforts on climate change. She spoke with us from the COP30 meeting on climate change underway right now in Belém, Brazil. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Online communities can be places of refuge, especially for persecuted minority groups seeking allies who might understand what they're going through. That is what motivated Ekpar Asat to create an online space for Uyghur culture. He's Uyghur from China and a digital innovator. Ekpar created a site where Uyghurs could share art, music, and memories. But Chinese authorities erased it, and then they erased him. Dina Temple-Rastan, host of the Click Here podcast, has Ekpar's story.
It was just before dawn, August 2015. Nabdouali Ayoub sat in the passenger seat of a borrowed car, watching the road disappear behind him. He was anxious, keeping an eye on the rearview mirror. He hadn't really slept in days, and when he did, he slept with his shoes on, in case the police came to take him away in the middle of the night.
Because, if they come directly to arrest me, I should be prepared, because in the jail, it's really cold, and nobody will help you. So I slept just like that.
He'd already been arrested once for something that didn't sound like much of a crime. He had tried to open a kindergarten, just a place where children could learn in their own language, the Uyghur language. But in northwest China, even that had become dangerous. Uyghur books were banned, cultural centers shuttered, people were watched and tracked. Even a children's school could be seen as a threat. This wasn't just censorship, it was something deeper, a systematic attempt to erase a people. Abdulwali had been caught in that wave, arrested, beaten, silenced. When he was finally released, more than a year later, he understood. Prison wasn't the end of his punishment. It was a warning. So he decided to make a break for it.
I just feel like somebody is following us. I was just keep looking at the mirror.
The man behind the wheel tried to reassure him. That man was Ekpar Asad. In another country, he might have been called a tech visionary or a civic innovator. He was the founder of Bagdash, a kind of Uyghur Facebook, a digital town square for sharing art and music and memories.
Yeah, it was voice for Uyghurs at that time. Like a chance for the Uyghur to express their feeling.
Online, the rules about what Uyghurs could or couldn't say seemed fuzzier. Write something controversial in state media, you could get arrested. But online?
The consequences is just delete the post.
Ekpar knew how to navigate all that. And he mentored others, like Abdulwali, so they could do the same.
He said that, like, if we keep that red line, police are understandable. We can work with them, he told me. We can work with the police.
The morning of that anxious ride, Ekpar had arranged everything. The ride, the flight, the cover story.
He was the only person I have seen the last day I left China. His face still, his face so innocent.
It was the last time he ever saw Ekpar. Before Bagdash, before the website, before any of that, Rehan Asad, Ekpar's older sister, remembers apples.
Maybe we were like 5, 6 years old. Like my mom would give me 2 apples and one is intentionally bigger than the other. And then she asked me to choose, which one would you want to give it to your brother? And I would choose the small one for myself and would give the bigger one to my brother.
It wasn't just a lesson in generosity. It was something deeper, a way to teach them where their loyalty should lie. And when she thinks back on those years, there's one image that always comes to mind. Ekpar, barely a teen, sitting in front of a massive, boxy computer monitor, the kind that looks like it belongs in a science museum now.
The computer overpowered him, so he's like this tiny teenager sitting in front of this chunky computer.
That was Ekpar, curious, quiet, focused, and already in love with machines that made sense to him, even when the rest of the world didn't. They had no way of knowing it then, but those afternoons spent huddled around the glitchy computers, those quiet conversations over tea, they were rehearsals for something bigger. Because as Ekpar grew older and the world around him shifted, he began to notice something was off, not just in the machines he'd love to fix, but in the larger system around him. The one that crushed the people who tried to question it. Ekpar had grown up in Urumqi, a city in China's far northwest, populated mostly by the country's Muslim minority. It's a place where the signs were in his language and the faces looked like his, and where being Uyghur wasn't something you had to explain. But when he went online, it was a different story. The digital world was in Mandarin, and the space for Uyghurs to express themselves barely existed. So he did what he always did. He started trying to fix that. It started in college, a simple website, a side project. He called it Bagdash. The name itself was a kind of message. Bagdash is a type of tree.
Bagdash is known as this kind of like a tree is known for its endurance of all sorts of seasons in life, right? Just like embodiment of different history, historical periods in which people's resilience really comes through.
Bagdash wasn't designed to go viral. It was designed to hold memory, to give people a place to see their culture reflected back at them. It started essentially as a blog and then grew from there.
So he started off just doing something as simple as that, but he realized that what if we connect people?
And it caught on. Ekpar knew that if he wanted Bagdash to survive, he had to grow it into something sustainable. But his parents didn't quite see it that way. To them, a government job was safe, predictable. Bagdash wasn't. But Rehan knew what her brother was building, and more importantly, who he was becoming. So she sat down with her parents and made the case. Let him do this, she told them, or risk watching him walk away from the one thing that gave him purpose.
And my parents finally came around under one condition, which is there's no financial support for him to do what he wants to do.
So at 22, Ekpar set out on his own. He wasn't chasing money. He was building something for his community. So he turned to that community.
He would reach out to this small, medium-sized company and say, like, you know, you are obviously doing a wonderful job, but your product is not known until it's seen on the internet. Just growing the platform to what it became known in the Uyghur homeland, that the leading platform in terms of social media.
A social network built from scratch for a people quietly being erased. Building something like Bagdash in a place like Xinjiang wasn't just ambitious, it was dangerous. The first test came from a city called Guja. A teacher there had filed a complaint. She said she had been sexually harassed by the principal of her school. She took the case to court, and she lost, and then lost her job. So she turned to the only place that might still listen, the platform Ekpar had built. She logged onto Bagdash and told her story. The post spread. People saw it, and instead of staying silent, they spoke up too.
They were actually commending her for her courage to speak up, her vulnerability. Just speaking truth to power.
And Rehan felt it, the way a single post could shift everything. She was studying in Canada by then, keeping an eye on Ekpar from afar. And she started to worry.
I got really scared. I called him and I said, are you okay?
Then something unexpected. The principal was fired and the teacher got her job back.
It also sparked a conversation around these kind of sensitive issues. And, you know, the government officials even ended up visiting my brother and kind of commended him for doing the right thing.
It looked like Ekpar had found a way to make it work. He hadn't just built a platform, he'd built trust with his users, with his community, and even, it seemed, with the state. But in Xinjiang, balance is fleeting, and silence doesn't always mean safety. The trouble began, as it so often does, with a news report. Word got around that two Uyghur men, thousands of miles from home, had been killed at a toy factory in southern China. And on July 5th, 2009, that rumor reached Urumqi. Thousands of Uyghurs took to the streets. They wanted answers. They wanted justice. And in the beginning, the marches were peaceful. But then something cracked. Stones were thrown. Police responded with a brutal crackdown. And by nightfall, Urumqi was no longer a city. It was a scream. Official reports would later say nearly 200 people were killed. Half were Han Chinese, and the other half were Uyghur. Beijing called it ethnic violence, Uyghur against Han Chinese. And then the government shut everything down, the internet, the phone lines, the digital heartbeat of the region. And with it, Bagdash disappeared too. The crackdown began with police pouring into Uyghur neighborhoods and rounding up more than 1,400 men. Checkpoints appeared like weeds, facial recognition cameras perched like hawks from every lamppost, and they sharpened the algorithms, clocking things that used to be just life as a Uyghur, beards, headscarves, overseas calls, deleted apps, foreign travel. Now all of that was considered evidence. And in the middle of this tightening came an unexpected reprieve, an invitation. In 2016, the U.S. State Department offered Ekbar a spot in a leadership program. 3 weeks in America to study civil society, journalism, the open internet.
My brother had to navigate the incredibly difficult world of getting a passport as a Uyghur person. You have to get a stamp from 18 different government organizations, and you have to pledge that your religion is only the Communist Party. Like, you know, all these sort of things.
And then, like something out of a dream, he was on a plane landing in America. Rehan was finishing her final year at Harvard Law School by then. She was knee-deep in finals, but she dropped everything and caught a late bus to New York just to see him.
And by the time I got to his hotel, it was really, really late. And so we got something from a deli. I bought some ice cream, just like, you know.
She was happy to see him, excited to catch up. But she was also there on a mission. She had been watching the crackdown from afar, and she wanted to warn him about the red lines that were moving from beneath his feet. Where she saw a noose tightening, he saw a path forward. Where she saw risk, he saw possibility. She wasn't sure he appreciated just how dangerous things had become. "Don't let your guard down while you're here," she said. "They have spies everywhere." And he nodded and said he would. Early the next morning, he walked her to the bus station. And then, just before they said goodbye, he pulled something from his bag, a copy of his State Department itinerary.
And he had an extra copy. And he's like, "Why don't you keep this as a souvenir?"
It was a list of his stops across the country and the officials he'd met, with phone numbers and emails and names. She tucked it into her bag without thinking, waved goodbye, and boarded a bus back to Boston. 3 weeks later, after he returned to China, Ekbar vanished.
And it took me a bit of time to realize, like, what happened to him. My parents were too scared to even tell me.
Eventually, word came. He'd been arrested. There was no evidence, no trial, no real explanation. He was just gone. When we reached out to the Chinese embassy about his case, they said they'd never even heard of Ekbar. But our sources told us the government did charge him, and that charge was inciting ethnic hatred. Rehan felt helpless. She was thousands of miles away, until she remembered the State Department itinerary Ekbar had handed her when he was in the States.
Like, maybe God was trying to tell me something, I just didn't listen.
It was like he left you a map.
Exactly, exactly.
Because inside were the names and numbers of people at the State Department, NGO staffers, organizers. So Rehan began desperately cold calling every name on the list.
I met with the State Department officials, told them what happened. I asked them, I said, "Can you privately advocate for him?"
They told her, in situations like this, it's often better not to be too loud. That can harden the captor's position. Their recommendation? To just wait it out. She knew how the system worked in China, how arbitrary it could be. And on the long list of reasons the Chinese government targets people, Ekbar had checked one of the boxes. Foreign travel. 4 years after he was arrested, she decided it was time to tell the world what had happened to Ekbar. She told the New York Times everything. All about Ekbar, the visit to America, the charges, the silencing of the Uyghur internet. And they ran a major story. There were op-eds, diplomatic inquiries, meetings at the UN, 2 visits to the Trump White House.
I hope as the U.S. and China continue to engage and find some sort of common ground, he would become part of some sort of exchange deal and they would secure his release.
And there was reason to hope. Just this spring, the Trump administration freed 15 political prisoners in Belarus, and it proved that deals like that could happen. A few months ago, something unexpected happened. Her parents were granted a visit with Ekbar. It had been more than a year since they'd seen their son, more than a year since anyone had. And the visit took place at Aksu Prison, one of the most notorious facilities in Xinjiang. Not just because of its isolation, but because of what happens inside. There are allegations of torture, political indoctrination, forced confessions. It took them 12 hours by train.
Ladies and gentlemen, we welcome you aboard the high-speed rail EMU trains.
Then came the layers of security, 3 checkpoints in all, and finally, just a few minutes, face-to-face. Even for someone as relentlessly optimistic as their son, the prison was wearing on him.
I think that was really painful for my parents. What did he do to deserve like this level of cruelty?
Now, this isn't just Ekpar's story. It isn't just Rayhan's. It's the story of more than a million other Uyghurs who have been detained, surveilled, and silenced since 2016. If it feels far away, look again, because authoritarianism never starts with camps. It tiptoes in, starts with something smaller, easy to dismiss. A book that's quietly removed from a syllabus, a website that gets taken down, or a diversity policy that's suddenly under review. At first, it's framed as protection. Then someone is called unpatriotic, then accused of being a threat, until finally, one day, the voices are gone. And by the time you realize the line has been crossed, the line has vanished.
For The World, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina is host of the Click Here podcast from Recorded Future News. It's part of a series we've been featuring on digital tools China uses to repress Uyghurs. Next week, the final chapter, one coder who's trying to preserve digital evidence of Uyghur culture as fast as Chinese authorities are erasing it. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Spain is well ahead of the pack in Europe when it comes to giving working dads time to stay home with their newborns. That is one of the big takeaways from a new report showing that in 2023, 42% of those who benefited from parental leave in Spain were men. In Sweden and Norway, it was only 28%. In Germany, it was single digits, just 7%. So what's Spain doing differently? Our partners at DW looked into it. Here's Ashish Sharma in Madrid.
A stone's throw away from Plaza Mayor at the very heart of Madrid, the Platform for Parental Equality, the PPIINA, is holding a 20th anniversary meeting. The organization has long championed that men can also be sole caregivers, and that giving both genders equal time off reduces discrimination against women in the workplace.
My name is Mariano Nieto Navarro. I'm part of this Spanish platform for equal paternity-maternity leaves. For fathers, the advantages are to change the traditional role, which has usually been an absent father. Not being absent means creating emotional link with your child and learning a lot of new skills for children also, having not only the mother but also the father psychologically. That's a very strong foundation for the development, the personality.
Loriano Martinez, a university lecturer at the Complutense University here in Madrid, took advantage of 16 weeks leave at full play when his son Vincent was born a few years ago. That leave has now been extended to 19 weeks.
We are both from Argentina, so we don't have family here to help us with the kids. At the beginning, the first 6 weeks, we spent together. And then I took 10 and she started working. And then she took 10 and I started working.
Did you feel, if I take 16 weeks out, I'm going to kind of fall behind in my career?
Yeah, it affects your career. My wife, she's also an academic, so we are in the same situation. For instance, 2 years after Valentine's Beard, we didn't publish anything, and we know publishing is really important in academics.
How much do you feel you've changed as a person?
You really value the act of taking care of someone else. That changed your mind because it can be difficult, it can be demanding, but when you leave that changed your viewpoint. I feel I'm more sensitive with social issues in general.
Loriano is one of very few men who was able to stagger his time off and separated from his wife's leave. In general, though, requesting paternity leave at different times is harder, which leads to men opting to take all the weeks off at one go. According to Mariano, this is due to red tape, which ends up reinforcing the role of the father as a support figure, as opposed to being a main carer.
Men are coined in the traditional role of being a helping hand. We believe that the main factor is a design of the legislation and the administrative burdens in order for the fathers to fraction their leave. The lower the income, the more difficult to fraction, to divide your leave. When there's a higher income, there's a higher negotiation with your employer.
I'm more comfortable if I sit down.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But there are reasons not related to bureaucracy which leads to men taking all their time off alongside their wives. Cristina Alvarez became a mother just 5 months ago for the first time. She says she wanted her husband to take his time off with her.
The main reason was that I was afraid of being alone with the child. It's our first child. Before the child was born, he started to read a lot about babies, about the things that, for example, I didn't do it.
And in terms of his job, how did the situation change for him?
He works in an insurance company, and his department is IT, and he didn't have any problem to ask for the leave. But he will return, and he told me, no, I think now I have my priority. And when I need to go to pick up the baby to the kindergarten, I will go and I will stop the meeting. You know, I won't care. The company will understand, we hope.
Cristina has returned to work and admits she's struggled to readjust. But she also says there are more important reasons than just professional ones for men having equal leave time.
It's not only about the professional career, but about your mental health. And your mental health affects all your life, so some of my colleagues or my friends that, for example, they couldn't benefit from these 16 weeks for the father, they suffer a lot. I mean, they didn't enjoy the months as, for example, as I have done, as we have done.
While there are reasons to celebrate the equality in parental leave in Spain, there is a clear next step that is now in focus. The legislation is too bureaucratic. Staggering leave means applying each time to Social Security, as well as liaising with employers, who find it easier if all the time is taken at once. But with the harder part of 19 weeks equal leave at full pay being achieved, tinkering with the edges should be, well, child's play. Ashish Sharma, DW, Madrid.
And finally today,
people are the ultimate spectacle.
Ain't that the truth? That's from the trailer to the 1969 film They Shoot Horses, Don't They?, about a wild dance marathon set during the Great Depression.
Winning a dance competition sounds a little different now. This is the kind of music that 34-year-old Hungarian dancer Szabolcs Csepa was listening to while playing Dance Dance Revolution. That is the video game where you stand on a mat or platform and put your feet where the arrows tell you to. Csepa played for 144 hours straight last month, breaking a Guinness World Record, as the people at Guinness have now confirmed.
Csepa says he burned through every song in the Dance Dance Revolution catalog. For Dance Dance Revolution insiders, a real surprise was Csepa's technique. He didn't even dance all those hours on a hard surface.
He did it on a soft mat. I'm not joking.
That's YouTuber S34N Videos noting that Csepa broke the record on the kind of mat people use to improve balance in physical therapy. Super challenging, evidently.
If you think you've got what it takes to outdance him, that is the kind of game you're up against. In the meantime, maybe dance like Guinness isn't watching.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for dancing with us today.
Heading towards the floor.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.